Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, multiple tragedies in the region this weekend. Severe storms causes significant damage in Roscoe, and one woman is dead after a microburst strikes the Roscoe campground. A small plane crashed in Delaware County, and emergency responders are searching for the five people on board. Plus, a swimmer drowns in the Delaware River. We'll have updates. Cannabis, from demonization to legalization. A short film by Brandy Morella discusses the history of the politicization of the plant and the efforts by her father, Frank Fioramonte, to decriminalize them. Plus, James B. Huntington from Workshift Live is here, and the events at the Liberty Library this month. It's coming up, but first the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The U.S. Supreme Court is beginning to issue some of the last opinions of this term. A highly anticipated decision involves whether presidents can be criminally charged for certain actions while they're in office. The case stems from federal charges against former President Donald Trump. It's over his actions around the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Democrats are still talking about President Biden's debate performance last week. Some media outlets, such as the New York Times editorial board, have called on him to leave the race. But publicly, NPR's Tamara Keith says top elected Democrats are backing Biden.
Biden was trailing Trump narrowly before the debate in most polls. So far, at least, the campaign doesn't think that that has dramatically changed. That's because the electorate is super polarized, and voters didn't start being worried about Biden's age on Thursday night. This is a pre-existing condition. The reality is Biden has already locked up the Democratic nomination and has enough pledged delegates to avoid a fight at the convention.
NPR's Tamara Keith reporting. Hungary is taking over the European Union's rotating presidency today. As NPR's Rob Schmitz reports, the country's nationalist prime minister is a longtime critic of the EU.
Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban says he wants to, quote, make Europe great again during his six-month turn at the rotating EU Council presidency. The populist leader repeatedly claims the EU threatens Hungarian sovereignty, is destroying its middle class and its agricultural sector, and he's vowed to shake up the power structures in Brussels. For its part, the EU has in recent years withheld tens of billions of dollars worth of funding to Hungary over Orban's many violations of the bloc's rule of law principles. Orban has taken away the independence of his country's judiciary and media, and he hasn't bothered to correctly implement the EU's asylum and migration laws. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
Stocks opened higher today to start this holiday-shortened week on Wall Street. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 215 points in early trading.
Boeing is taking a key supplier back under its corporate wing. The jetmaker announced it will repurchase Spirit AeroSystems for $4.7 billion. Boeing had previously spun off Spirit, which makes fuselages. Bringing that manufacturing in-house once again is intended to improve quality and safety. European stocks open higher today after a strong showing by France's National Rally Party over the weekend during the first round of parliamentary elections. A second round of voting is set for next Sunday. Asian stocks were also up overnight as the Japanese yen fell further against the U.S. dollar. Markets in Hong Kong were closed for a holiday. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, stocks have turned mixed. The Dow is up about 200 points. The Nasdaq is down a point. This is NPR. The National Hurricane Center says Hurricane Beryl is again a major Category 4 storm. Its top sustained winds have surged back up to 130 miles per hour. The very dangerous storm is just off the southern Caribbean islands of Grenada and St. Vincent and the Grenadines. It will soon make landfall. Forecasters warn that it's not just the hurricane's wind that is dangerous. The storm surge will be several feet high and will be life-threatening. Today, Minnesota becomes the 15th state to open access to original birth certificates for adoptees who were born in the state. The change comes as more people are discovering their birth parents through DNA testing kits. From member station KAXE, Chelsea Perkins has more.
With an estimated 172,000 birth records becoming available to adoptees or their close relatives, officials in Minnesota expect a huge influx of requests. State Registrar Molly Crawford says it will likely be an emotional time for all those involved in closed adoptions, but she says DNA kits and shifting societal attitudes have laid the groundwork for today.
Parents and adopted people have connected through other means, and the expectations around what should be held private and confidential have changed.
While the state can no longer withhold these records, birth parents can still indicate their preferences on being contacted. For NPR News, I'm Chelsea Perkins in Brainerd, Minnesota.
The Grand Slam Wimbledon Tennis Championship starts today in Britain. The defending champs are Carlos Alcaraz and Marketa Vondroušová. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Supreme Court of the United States is likely to issue an opinion in the case of Donald Trump versus the U.S. today. We don't know the precise timing, but it's likely to happen during the show in the 10 a.m. hour after a court begins session. That's the case that decides the question of whether the former president has immunity from prosecution on charges of attempting to subvert the 2020 presidential election results. Once we get that announcement, we will go to NPR's live coverage. First, though, we start with some tragic news this weekend in multiple locations across the region. First, a woman was killed after a severe storm struck a popular local campground in Delaware County near the Sullivan County border on Sunday. Initial reports suggested that a tornado had touched down in the area. However, the National Weather Service in Binghamton confirmed that the storm was a microburst, not a tornado, with winds reaching 90 miles an hour, about 1 mile northwest of Cook's Falls. The microburst tore through the Russell Brook campsites around 10:35 Sunday morning. A woman from Edison, New Jersey, died when the storm snapped a large tree that fell on her camper. A second person was also injured, authorities said. According to the National Weather Service, many RVs, campers, tents, and several cars were heavily damaged as well. Also yesterday in Delaware County, emergency responders were searching for a small plane carrying five people that crashed outside the Catskill Park Sunday afternoon. The plane, a single-engine Piper PA-46, crashed around 2 p.m., the FAA said. The National Transportation Safety Board is leading an investigation. It was not immediately clear what caused the crash or whether there were any injuries or fatalities. The search was initially focused on an area near Trout Creek, New York, which is about 1 hour northwest of our studios here in Liberty. Sarah Taylor Sulik, a public affairs specialist at the NTSB, told the New York Times this morning that, quote, "It's our understanding that the plane has not yet been located, and local authorities are conducting a search," end quote. And Saturday on the Delaware River, a South Jersey man drowned while swimming off Milford Beach at the Delaware Water Gap in Pennsylvania, officials said Saturday. About 4 hours after going missing, divers retrieved the body of 24-year-old Jason Ariel Osorio Riaz of Jackson Township in Ocean County, New Jersey, National Park Service officials said. Osorio Riaz, according to a witness, was seen swimming around 3:15 p.m. about 75 yards from the shoreline in Pennsylvania before vanishing underwater. His body was found around 7 p.m. Saturday. The National Park Service was aided in the search by local firefighters and divers. The National Park Service advises swimmers to stay within guarded beaches as the Delaware River often has strong currents, sharp drop-offs, and other conditions that can make the waterway dangerous. Radio Catskill reporter Chia Tien Nicole Chen spoke to Susie Casper of the National Park Service about how to stay safe on the water.
Hi, I'm Susie Casper, and I'm a park ranger for the National Park Service at Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River.
So, Susie, I'm always hearing people say that the Upper Delaware is deceiving. What do they mean by that?
The river is very deceiving. So the river levels fluctuate so very much. It's incredible. There's literally spots where it's inches deep, you know, especially at lower normal water levels. And then you can walk literally halfway across the river, and then all of a sudden you have a 10, 15 foot hole where it suddenly drops off. And it can be very deceiving, especially, you know, the deeper parts of the river, it looks calm. It looks placid. It looks like a pool. And that's where most folks have learned to swim, is in a pool or a lake where they're not fighting those natural water features like a fast moving river current. But that's, you know, it's not uncommon to just be in shallow water. And then all of a sudden you take a step or two and then you're in way over your head in fast moving water. And we have unfortunately had a few drownings where folks didn't know how to swim, but they were only in ankle deep water. So it wasn't concerning. And then all of a sudden, the next thing you know, you're in over your head and struggling and you're fighting that current. So we had one fatality last year. Yeah. And then the year before there was three, unfortunately. So
is there any pattern to the cause behind these drownings?
Yeah. So in 2011, we had a rash of five drownings in just the matter of 2 months or so. Of course, everyone is very shocked, like, oh my goodness, what's happening? So we really started to look into our statistics, who was drowning, why they were drowning. And we kind of came to the conclusion that more often than not, these folks were actually swimming when the drowning occurred. So they may have been on a boat, but they pulled off to shore and engaged in the activity of swimming. So, you know, anybody, doesn't matter if you're an Olympic swimmer, if you're fighting a current and you're swimming, you're eventually going to get fatigued. So that's why we always encourage, if you're going to swim in the river, just please wear a life jacket, because at least you, if you're not going to get back to the same spot where you're at, it's going to keep you afloat and you're not going to have any issues there.
Let's talk about that a little more. So say you're swimming in the river and then you suddenly find yourself being swept away by a current. What should you do?
Yeah, the best thing to do, and this is also rule of thumb if your canoe or kayak capsizes, what you want to do is you want to float on your back. People think, well, that seems silly because that's not how you swim. You swim, you know, usually front forward. But the river, because the current moves so fast, it can actually push you into a rock or a log or something like that. And the water moves so fast, you don't realize it. So you don't want your head facing forward. You want your feet to face forward. So you float on your back with your feet pointed towards the sky. Use your arms to steer yourself to shore. And that's the best method. And if you have your life jacket on, it's so much easier because you can just float and you don't have to worry.
So say you're not the person who's caught in current. Maybe you just saw someone in a dangerous situation. Maybe you saw a boat capsize. What should you do as a bystander?
That's really important. I'm really glad you brought that up because we have had many times on the river double drownings. Even if you have a life jacket on and you go in after a drowning person, especially if it's an adult, they can easily pull you underwater because a drowning person, you know, they can't see, they can't hear. They're in the process of drowning. They're obviously not breathing hardly. They can't talk. They are looking to get air. So they will climb on top of you and pull you under. It doesn't matter if you're a parent, a friend, a spouse, that they are just trying to get a breath of air. And so that's when a double drowning can occur. So we always say reach, row, throw, go. So if you can reach for the person, say, and you're in a boat, you can throw them something like a life jacket or the seat cushions for their boats. You can throw them that. You can throw them a rope. It could be literally anything as long as it floats, something they can grab onto, or, you know, go get help. Because, you know, people can be rescued if they've been underwater for a short amount of time. But if you're not prepared to rescue somebody, don't do it because it could ultimately end in your death as well.
Do you have any tips on how to find the right fitting life jacket?
So here on the Upper Delaware specifically, adults have to have their life jacket with them. Of course, it has to fit. So they all have that Coast Guard label and it shows how it fits you by your weight or by your chest size. If they're not securely fastened and nice and snug on you, the life jacket can actually come up over your head and then actually can hinder you more than it's going to help you because you can't see. I've actually seen people almost drown inside their life jackets a couple of times because it almost creates more of a hazard. So if it has to be on you and it has to be nice and snug, if it's not, it's not going to help you a whole lot. But for children, we always recommend that, kids grow so fast. So if you're heading out in the water, you know, before the season starts, put them in their life jackets, make sure they fit and they're nice and snug. Also, you know, if they're too small, kids, they get uncomfortable, they're too tight, they don't want to wear them. But it is a requirement that children on the river, when you're underway in a boat, 12 and under, have to be wearing them at all times.
Aside from getting a life jacket, what should people do to prepare for the activities on the water?
Oh, there's so many different things. So we just got out of a major heat wave where it was 90 plus degrees, it seemed like every day. But even when it's not super hot, hydration is super important. You know, lots of people like to have an adult beverage on the river, which is okay, as long as you're mixing it with water. You don't realize how much energy you're expelling when you're on the river, especially when it's hot. So having water or sports drinks, you know, to replenish your electrolytes, salty snacks, you know, having, you know, eating a good meal when you're out there. And then, of course, you know, sunscreen. We were out there training this past week and we probably applied sunblock. It felt like every 15 minutes because the sun was just so hot and strong. We see people that come out of the river looking like lobsters. So just making sure you're protecting yourself from the elements. That being said, too, so yesterday it was, I think, like 87 degrees. Today it's a high of 77. So believe it or not, we have more cases of hypothermia in the summer months than we actually do in the winter months, because obviously there's more boaters out there. But we all live in the Pocono Mountains in the Sullivan County Catskills, and the weather changes so quickly. So if you find yourself in the water for a prolonged amount of time, and maybe that cool afternoon thunderstorm rolls by, you've only got your bathing suit, it can get really chilly really quickly. So that's something super important to keep in mind as well. We recommend folks make sure we say file a float plan, but it's really just letting your family and friends know where you're going and when you expect to return. That way, in case, and of course, we don't recommend boating alone ever, but just in case something happens, you maybe have a raft and your raft might deflate on the side of the river, and now you're in a remote spot and nobody can find you. So we want to make sure that people know where you're at, and if something should happen, where they can find you. So just being really extra prepared, you know, having medications, bug spray. There was a lot of horse flies out there yesterday, too. So you're kind of in the wilderness. So being prepared to be outdoors for several hours and then some.
And I know that the Park Service has a lot of water safety resources. So could you go through what they are, describe where our listeners can find them?
Yeah, so we have on our website, so it's NPS, so that stands for National Park Service, .gov. /UPDE, that stands for Upper Delaware. And we have a whole planning your river trip section on our website, that gives you all kinds of different tips, how to plan your river trip, what you need to bring, you know, life jacket requirements, the river gauges, which is super important too. It's always super important to know what the river conditions are going to be before you go out there, because, you know, where we have heavy rainstorms, the river will rise a couple of feet overnight. And most people are used to being on the river when it's, you know, at a normal level. But, you know, when it reaches, you know, over 5 or 6 feet, the rapids can be quite a bit more dangerous. So our website has a lot of good information. We also post updates when river conditions change on our social media accounts. So Facebook and Instagram, and you can link to those from our website as well.
And you also mentioned earlier that if you see a dangerous situation on the river, you can call someone. Who should we call?
Yeah, so it's tricky in the River Valley because, as we all know, there's not great cell phone service. So the best thing to do is just call 911, because it's not just the Park Service that's out there. We have a lot of volunteer fire companies, you know, local EMS who will respond as well as us. And, you know, as we all know, who, you know, we live in a very remote area, response time can be, it's not going to be 5 minutes. You know, it's going to be a little bit longer than that. So just calling 911 is the best thing to do. And then, of course, our dispatch phone number is also on our website. So for emergencies, you can call them as well. Also, too, I just want to mention that, you know, somebody who's drowning, they can't yell for help. Remember, their esophagus is closed up. They're trying to gasp for air. So it's important when you're out there with the rest of your family and friends, you know, everybody's out there having a great time, but keep an eye on your friends and your family, because we've had many drownings happen when people are all in and out of the water. Then all of a sudden their friend is missing. They didn't even know it until a few minutes later, and that's too late. So keep an eye on your friends and your family, encourage them to wear their life jackets. You know, it doesn't matter if you're a good swimmer, the river is stronger than you. Now, the river can fatigue even the best of swimmers. So just make sure you have that life jacket. It has to be accessible so that way if somebody is struggling in the water, somebody can quickly throw it to you. Or if your boat capsizes, you know, you have the opportunity to grab onto it.
Yeah, that's key. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know it's been really busy, so.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Really, I really do. If it saves one life, it's worth it.
From Liberty, it's Jatin Nicole Chen for Radio Catskill.
And a reminder, you can find those resources at nps.gov/UPDE. We'll take a break, and when we come back, James B. Huntington with Work Shift Live, Local Economic Perspective. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, the economics of Broadway are very tough, but things are working out for the new hit show Stereophonic.
We just keep saying over and over again, when will it slow down? When will this slow down? When will it sort of stop? And it just has not yet.
And can the unlikely success of Stereophonic help change the grim future of the theater?
We are more than just a luxury.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. That song you hear means it's time for Work Shift Live with James B. Huntington, local economist and author, with some local economic perspective for us on a Monday. Good morning, James B.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
All right, let's start off with the Fed and their preferred inflation measure last week. I didn't realize there was a preferred inflation measure.
Well, there are about three of them, and this one is generally described as their favorite. It's the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index. It went up 2.6% annually in May, which was down from 2.7% in April. There's also a core price measure of this, which strips out food and fuel prices, and that was also 2.6%, which was down from 0.2% in the April reading. So what this means, for one thing, is that there is a higher chance of having interest rates drop as soon as September. It would not be a large amount. It might only be 0.25%, but the odds of that happening got a little shorter with this report. Looking good, we're still short, or we're not short, we're still heavy above the 2% that they want to see, but it's going down quite a bit, continuing to go down. So the chances are that it may be around 2% by the end of the year.
We continue to look and wait. You've got a story here about money dysmorphia. What is that? And is it just sort of a new term for something we already know? And how many people have had it?
Well, it was a new one on me. I mean, money dysmorphia is described as being irrationally insecure about finances, thinking you can't spend as much money as you reasonably can. So that is applying to more and more people, especially really the Generation Z folks. That's what seems to be where it was the most common. But in a survey here, they're describing 29% saying they have experienced money dysmorphia one time or another. So it's understandable. Whether there's a variety of news and there is a feeling among some people that the news isn't accurate, so they're getting more afraid that they are going to be victimized because of the job market getting weaker, although it's still quite strong. And the idea, especially for the younger people, there are sets of expectations out there, which are not always reasonable, saying here's what you should have accomplished by the time you turn 30. And a great deal of people are not there at all. Most people are not, do not really start behaving themselves overall financially until they're in their 30s. So nothing rare, but I mean, it's easy to be scared more, thinking they're going to lose their job, or maybe thinking inflation is higher than it is, and tightening up on spending. It can be a very good idea to do that, but realize you're doing that based on the right information. And if you're in good shape and are in a good field and rate to get another job quickly if you lose yours somehow, then you may have a look at whether you are might be worrying a bit more than you need to about your finances.
A little bit of stress moving in there, but people are tightening their belt a little bit. Even with fast food, it seems that some fast food chains are seeing falling sales, weak sales growth for fast food chains like McDonald's, grappling with reduced traffic as more people are eating at home or just saving their money elsewhere. What are these fast food chains trying to do to combat that?
Well, it's a real news item about the fast food chains is that they are being perceived more and more as being expensive. I mean, I keep hearing from people things like it costs $15 to eat at McDonald's. I might as well just go to a sit-down place or something. So a lot of perceptions, and they have denied that the numbers are as bad as some people think, but they're pretty bad. I can tell you as a McChicken consumer, as a off and on McChicken consumer, those things have almost tripled in price in the last 5 years. And it's a darn good price when I can get one for under $2 when it was $1.29 consistently at the end of the last decade.
Well, for years, fast food used to outpace inflation. It used to be, you would never think that it was too expensive, but I guess that's finally kind of caught up.
Well, it really was decently cheap. To take McDonald's as an example, they had their value menu with a whole string of $1 sandwiches, and most people could make it on two or something. That's $2. But now if it's three at a lot of places, you're getting six-something with the tax, and it's up higher. And if you want fries, a couple dollars more. If you want drinks, a couple dollars on top of that. So you are getting into double figures remarkably quickly. But, I mean, everyone is different, and prices are not the same nationwide. McDonald's is almost all franchises that have a lot of freedom in how to set their prices and local differences. But what we're having, back to your question already, there are a series of $5 meal deals that are going on. McDonald's has created one which has two different sandwiches, possibly one of two, with small fries, a four-piece McNuggets, and a small soda for $5, plus tax, of course. That's getting some interest and attention. It is an improvement. It's not a massive improvement over what some of these things cost. Then we have Wendy's, where they've had a $5 Biggie Bag offer, and this is only through June 3rd. So it's gone already, but these things have a way of coming back if they like how they work. You get a free small Frosty added on to the one of two sandwiches and chicken nuggets and fries and a drink. So that's getting to be a pretty good deal, five different things for $5 these days. And Burger King is bringing back their $5 Your Way meal, and they're going to do it earlier than they had originally planned. And you get one of three sandwiches along with, as before, chicken nuggets, french fries, and a drink. And those are getting pretty decent. But yeah, I mean, we're seeing a lot of hedges and limited time, and this will only be for 4 weeks and blah, blah, blah. But you can bet that if they get the results they want from these things, they will continue doing something like that, unless they're really losing money at it, which I doubt. And they're
trying to consider lure people back.
Fast food, maybe they want fast food to really come back as a cheap as well as a convenient way of people eating, and they will cut prices as they need to get there.
All right. Let's talk about some of the controversy around credit card fees. We're talking about limiting the fees credit card companies can charge, but there's some more discussion about that.
Well, there is this case that you've probably heard of Visa and MasterCard being ordered to pay a substantial amount of money because they were overcharging, as our federal government considered, for the swipe fees, which of course are the amounts of money that merchants pay credit cards when people come in and use them. They offered to pay $30 billion total to settle this, and the district judge, who is actually in New York State here, wrote an 88-page opinion, and she said that was too low. She said that the credit card companies would be able to handle paying more than that. So that's what she's looking to do. Now, the effect was really going to be very small. I mean, I wrote down on the text of this article, puny, next to one of the things it said here. It would be $6 billion in savings for merchants, and it would cut the swipe fees by only 0.04%. And right now, we are in a turmoil with how to pay for things. 5 years ago, it was almost every place would take credit cards with no extra charge or take cash. Now we get more and more people are getting to attempts or succeeding in getting these swipe fees back and adding amounts of money. I'm sure you've seen it out there.
Yeah.
Where they're, and sometimes it's announced in advance and sometimes it isn't. And there are some places that will not take cash at all, swinging the other way, where the law allows, which is not plain everywhere. And yeah, then there are some who are only taking cash. I had that popped on me after a $70 dinner at one place that said, it's cash only. Oh, we have an ATM. Well, some of us don't like to be hit right then for taking money out of our accounts and paying a service charge, as per last week's conversation about reverse ATMs. So it's chaotic enough as it is, and it's uncomfortable, and I would guess that less than half of businesses are taking credit cards and cash and not charging anything extra for either one.
Well,
so this is not good, but they will resolve this thing, and they will come up with something better than 0.04%.
Yeah, they'll have to settle or go to trial. All right, before we go, let's check the numbers. How did things go last week with stock, oil, precious metal, and any updates from this morning?
Okay, as of very early this morning, gold was $23.28 an ounce, exactly the same as a week ago. Silver, though, dropped to $29.17. That's 0.46, 46 cents down. Ratio is just under 80 to 1, which is really sort of normal-ish now, so they're in line with each other. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, 39.119, down 31, which is very close to breaking even, a real nothing week. NASDAQ did better the other way, 17,733, up 44. No, not much different. No, given the lower balance, it's a small but slightly significant amounts, but still not a lot going on. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, 81.91, the 42-gallon barrel, up 94 cents, creeping up. Bitcoin, 62,856. Plus 368. That is so volatile that that's really close to breaking even. British pound, 1.2682, up 50 hundredths of a cent. The euro, 1.0768, up 44 hundredths of a cent. Those are gaining some strength now, but not a great deal. Japanese 100 yen, though, coin hit another multi-year low at 62 cents. So overall, it really was a dull week. Not much was going on. We don't know. It seemed that we had lots of news in other areas of the country, but it all sort of evened out last week.
Yeah, probably not that much news this week on a shortened trading week with the July 4th holiday. James B. Huntington, Workshift Live, Local Economic Perspective, every Monday. Thank you so much. We'll let you go get that McChicken.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
Take cash.
Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by. It's all taking
and we'll take a break, and when we come back, cannabis from demonization to legalization. We speak to artist Brandy Marola about her latest visual installation at the Narrowsburg Union. This is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, episode one of our two-part investigation into this strange death around the death of a man in a U.S. immigrant detention center. We look into why and how Jose de Jesus died, who runs immigration detention centers, and who's accountable for taking care of the people there. That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Cannabis has been cultivated around the world for centuries. However, the plant has been politicized and stigmatized in the U.S. for the last 100 years. Frank Fioramonte was a young lawyer who wanted to be a people's advocate right out of law school. In 1970, Fioramonte was hired by NORML in New York City, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. In 1977, because of NORML's work, marijuana was decriminalized in New York. Artist Brandy Marola was Fioramonte's stepdaughter, and she's created a visual installation on view at the Narrowsburg Union called Cannabis from Demonization to Legalization, which is a history of the stigmatization of cannabis and a tribute to Fioramonte and his reform efforts. And Brandy Marola joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So I've talked about the history of this that you weave in with your stepfather, Frank Fioramonte. It's a chronicle of the, you know, the demonization to legalization, but your stepfather's role in that movement. Let's tell folks a little bit more about him. I mentioned he was a lawyer, worked for NORML. What was NORML and how did he become involved?
So I'll start with this. The 20-minute documentary I created tells the story of cannabis throughout history and across the planet. As far back as 600 BC in China, cannabis was one of the oldest known agricultural crops. Right out of law school, my stepdad Frank was hired by NORML, which is an acronym for National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. And Frank was one of two legislative lawyers tasked to craft the law for decriminalization in New York State. NORML was a group of highly educated men and women who all wanted reform to reform the unjust New York State laws for possession, use, and sales of this plant. And it was a perfect fit for my stepfather because he had been a public servant and he was aligned with NORML's objectives. The social component of NORML's efforts was to address how men of color were four times more likely to serve hard jail time than white men for the same offenses. And it was a civil rights cause in that respect.
Mm-hmm. It's mentioned in the film that NORML, of course, worked to reform these laws. How did they change? Well, how was it demonized? I mean, we mentioned in the intro that for centuries it was used, but then there was this period where it became demonized in the United States. I mean, it was even at one point, as you say in your film, available in pharmacies.
Yes.
as a medication. So how did it become demonized? What was that catalyst?
Great question. So cannabis was legal and sold in U.S. pharmacies in the 1850s after a decade of test studies. But in the 1930s, the U.S. government's Federal Bureau of Narcotics was founded, and they prioritized the prohibition of marijuana with outright racist rationale. Then the agency partnered with a church group to produce the propaganda film Reefer Madness in 1936. That film poisoned the public perception of the plant for 40 years to come, all based on lies. NORML diligently reshaped public perception away from the lies, educating the public with science and defending the benefits of marijuana.
All right. So your stepfather, I keep saying father, he was a lawyer. He was also a stepfather. Were you aware of his job? And, you know, as I was growing up, it was still that period of time where it was demonized, you know, and it was bad for you and terrible. How was it addressed in your home?
Well, I grew up in New York City in the 60s and 70s, where smoking pot was, though illegal, it was part of the culture, so it was very normal for us.
I grew up in Indiana, so yeah. Completely different.
Yeah, and I wasn't smoking pot as a child. Not advocate. So Frank was never a drug advocate, but rather a legislative lobbyist promoting fair adult use marijuana laws. And we were always very proud of his work.
Yeah. He collected all types of memorabilia, marijuana memorabilia that either people sent him or he had as part of his work. Which was sort of the spark to create this film. It's on display at the Union, some of it on the walls there, also in the documentary. When he passed away and you had this, you know, stockpile of memorabilia, was your initial reaction to, I'll create a documentary? Or what was the catalyst for this, the spark for this?
Well, Frank was a collector, so immediately I just thought, I have to do something with this to honor him. Mm. And so he passed away unexpectedly 9 years ago. He kept all of the marijuana merchandise given to him over a 10-year period. People across the country always sent Frank tokens of their appreciation for his hard work towards decriminalization in the form of posters, T-shirts, buttons, and many, many, many types of rolling papers. I knew I had to preserve the history, and after the New York State legalization was passed in 2021, I began to illustrate this history using Frank's quote-unquote artifacts to honor his memory and to tell this story.
There are a lot of interesting artifacts there. There's the Foxy Brown rolling papers.
Right.
Saw those. What was the other one that kind of
Watergate
stuck out to
you? Watergate.
Yeah, that was the one. Right. Yeah. Cool. So those are all on display there, and you can experience those. What do you? Well, you know, we talk about the history of it. It's a 20-minute film, so you're not able to capture all of it. But you do give a very good arc of how it was utilized and then demonized and now legalized. Do you still think there's a stigma around it?
Yes, because I believe that the stigma is slowly fading away, though there are those who will never learn to accept this drug. So it's a process, and in time, I hope it will be normalized. And when you actually see medical benefits of the plant, it's compelling. And why wouldn't you want your friends or family to get relief from a plant?
Right. Yeah. What is the phrase that says it's a weed that turns into a flower in your mind?
That's right.
Also the quote on display.
Yeah.
What do you hope folks take away from seeing your film?
I hope people better understand the demonization of the plant through the film and embrace a new era of legalization where, like, alcohol is no longer prohibited in New York State, and that consumers of cannabis are no longer stigmatized. That would be nice.
Yeah. How long is it on display at the Union?
It's running through September, and okay. I can give you dates.
Yeah.
So it's running at 7 Erie Avenue at the Narsburg Union Digital Gallery. It's a room. It's an immersive room with images on the wall and on screens, and it's quite fun and animated. And it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., Sunday, 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. It's free to the public. And
you can go in at any time. It's not like there's a scheduled viewing.
Anytime. It's on a loop.
Yeah, it's on a loop, but you can kind of walk in and sit and enjoy it. I went yesterday and saw. And what will you do with all this memorabilia once you're finished?
Well, presently it's in my family's possession, but perhaps it can all go to a cannabis museum somewhere one day to preserve the history. Frank would have loved that, but, you know, it's all open right now. I'm just, you know, one step at a time.
I imagine there's more of it than we saw on display.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was edited because there's so much stuff.
There's a lot.
But,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's very interesting how you are able to weave this narrative of the history, but also what I was struck by was just the tribute to him and the effort to personify what he was trying to do and reform. What also stuck out to me was the acronym NORMAL really was adequate and appropriate for the guys that were there. I think there's a quote in there where they say, oh, we were just these normal guys and we were able to get things done because we looked normal.
Yeah.
People were listening to them while they were advocating for something at the time, which was deemed somewhat, you know, controversial or stigmatized.
And they were super articulate, all went to Ivy League schools, all lawyers. I mean, it was a whole group of people who just had this this drive to make the law just.
Yeah. And Frank was became a professor at NYU, his alma mater as well.
He taught at NYU the history of drugs and the law. And he was the expert. He had so many books, I couldn't even show them all in that piece. But he was very well versed, never judging. He was a great person. And I really think, like my family said, he would have loved this.
Yeah.
And that really makes it all worthwhile.
Yeah. You know, she's smiling right now. You can see the broad grin on her face. Brandi Merola, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, too. Thank you.
Okay, we'll take a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
You hear that? It's a musical picture of Havana late at night, played by the Perez Prado Orchestra. We'll hear it on this week's Retro Cocktail Hour. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point.
Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, an effort to remind the country of the humanity in all of us. I'm Isabel Braverman, and we are pairing up strangers in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania to have conversations, not debates. Get to know your neighbors. Let's take one small step away from division and toward each other. Sign up at WJFFradio.org.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Supreme Court has issued an opinion in the case of Trump versus the United States that decides the question of whether the former president has immunity from prosecution of trying to subvert the 2020 presidential election results. Let's join special coverage.
This is live special coverage from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. We have a decision in the Supreme Court case that will determine whether former President Donald Trump is immune from prosecution. The court has ruled that a former president does have absolute immunity for his core constitutional powers while carrying out official acts, but not for unofficial acts. In Trump versus the United States, Chief Justice Roberts wrote the majority opinion. The Supreme Court voted 6-3, ruling that former presidents have absolute immunity, as we said, from official acts. At stake was whether or not Trump could be prosecuted for his role in the January 6th mob attack on the Capitol. Trump claimed absolute immunity after special counsel Jack Smith charged him with conspiring to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Trump argued his actions taken while in office were immune from prosecution. As you can tell, that this is a complicated decision and there's some nuance there. So we're going to turn first to national justice correspondent Carrie Johnson for her take on this. Tell us what we know so far.
Michelle, this seems to be another short-term victory for former President Donald Trump. The court has sided with him in significant respects and in other respects has ordered this case to be returned to the district judge, Tanya Chutkan, to make determinations about some of the allegations in the indictment. Trump's contacts with former Vice President Mike Pence, for instance, his contacts with state election officials and other private actors, to figure out whether Trump should enjoy some immunity along those lines. But the long and the short of it is that at least part of the indictment against Donald Trump for his involvement in the January 6th siege on the Capitol may go away. And the rest of it will have to go back down to the district judge to figure out what remains and how quickly he can be sent to trial. The odds of a trial this year before the election now seem even more dim than earlier.
What exactly will go to the back to the lower court judge? Is it her job now to determine which acts are official acts and which acts are not official acts? Because that was a matter of dispute even during the oral argument. As you said, there was back and forth about that for a good part of the oral argument before the court.
You've got that right. And in his majority opinion today, Chief Justice Roberts basically said the district court and the appeals court moved very quickly in this case. They did not do the kind of analysis that the Supreme Court wanted to see. And he's sending it back with certain kinds of instructions and hints.
And what about the minority? Can you tell us the 6-3 opinion? First of all, were the six united in their decision behind the Chief Justice?
Largely along ideological lines, the conservatives sided with the Chief Justice to say that Trump appears, as a former president, to have absolute immunity for his core constitutional powers, things like appointing ambassadors, recognizing foreign governments, and there's a presumption of immunity for his official acts. Maybe his contacts with Pence and the Justice Department, but those private acts, those acts with state election officials leaning on them and the like, maybe no immunity there. With respect to the dissent, there's a strongly worded dissent from Justice Sonia Sotomayor. She was joined by the other two liberals on the court. She says the majority here reshapes the institution of the presidency and makes a mockery of the principle that no man is above the law. She says our Constitution does not shield a former president from answering for criminal and treasonous conduct, and she dissents.
And did the other members of the other progressives, liberals on the court agree with her?
That's exactly right. This dissent by Sotomayor was joined by Jackson and Kagan as well.
We need to take a short break, and we are going to be right back with live special coverage of the Supreme Court's decision on presidential immunity from NPR News. We hope you'll stay with us.
Thank you for all the ways you help WJFF Radio Catskill. Your support sustains the news, music, and local voices that make up WJFF. It's only possible because of your generosity. Help keep it going. Consider signing up to be a sound supporter to make sure Radio Catskill has your constant support. Go to WJFFradio.org. And thank you for supporting public radio in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, matching strangers with different political beliefs to just have a conversation about their lives. Hi, I'm Judy Balaban, and I'm working on One Small Step at Radio Catskill. Help bring our community together, one conversation at a time. Go to WJFFradio.org and click on the One Small Step logo to join us.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Radio Catskill supporters include SUNY Sullivan, a community college in the Sullivan Catskills focused on preparing students for the future. More information at sunysullivan.edu. Livingston Manor, dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Park. LivingstonManorNY.com. And listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. We're bringing you continuing live coverage from NPR. The Supreme Court ruled that former President Donald Trump is entitled to some level of immunity from prosecution, a decision that may effectively delay the trial of the case against him on charges of plotting to subvert the 2020 election. The vote was 6-3, dividing along partisan lines. Let's return to NPR coverage.
We are back with live special coverage from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We're talking about the decision in the Supreme Court case that will determine whether former President Donald Trump is immune from prosecution. The court has ruled that a former president does have absolute immunity for his quote-unquote core constitutional powers while carrying out official acts, but not for unofficial acts. We've heard first from National Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. We're going to hear now from Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving. I just have one more question for Carrie, though, before we go to Ron. Many people will remember that former President Trump was found guilty on 34 felony accounts of falsifying business records. That is a separate matter. I just want to clarify for people who are wondering, does this Supreme Court decision affect that at all?
It does not appear to affect that at all. That's a state case brought by the Manhattan District Attorney. And a lot of the conduct in that case, of course, took place during the 2016 election before Donald Trump was president of the United States.
So we're going to go now to Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving, who's also here with us. Good morning, Ron.
Good to be with you.
So what does this mean for Trump's presidential run?
The first thing we have heard from the Trump campaign is that they're calling this a major victory. And certainly from the standpoint of whether or not there was going to be a trial before the election, it would so seem. It would appear to be a free pass for the Trump campaign to continue through November. And if they win, that would then give them presumably the power to make the Justice Department withdraw these charges. So if a trial has not happened by the time we get to January 20th of 2025, and there is a new President Trump, a second President Trump, if you will, then perhaps all of this entire enterprise will simply go away, including all of the evidence that was gathered and shown to the grand jury, all the testimony from Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, all the testimony regarding what Mike Pence was told by the president. All of that would not reach the public. So that is a very real possibility, and that is why the Trump folks are calling this a major victory. Now, of course, if Trump were defeated in November, then the trial could go forward, assuming that there will be a trial, and that that trial could still have consequence with respect to Donald Trump. and the sentence that could be meted out to him should he be found guilty. But those are a lot of ifs. The one thing that is clear is that there won't be a trial right away. It's going to go back down to Judge Chutkan, as Carrie was describing. And that that could take some time, because she's got to sort out what can be called official acts and what cannot. And that, too, may well be appealed. So we're probably looking at weeks, months, possibly through the election time before all of this gets resolved, just with respect to the federal charges. The state charges are another matter.
Let's go to NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro, who is also here with us. Good morning, Domenico.
Good to be with you, Michelle.
So we just heard that Donald Trump, former President Trump, through his Truth Social platform, is calling this a big win for our Constitution and democracy. Proud to be an American. Have we heard anything from the White House or from the Biden campaign?
Yeah, they say that the ruling doesn't change the facts, that what happened on January 6th, Donald Trump, quote, snapped after he lost the 2020 election and encouraged a mob to overthrow the results of a free and fair election. And they say that the American people already rejected Donald Trump's self-obsessed quest for power. Once Joe Biden will make sure they reject it for good in November. So, you know, they're sort of doing what they've done in the past, which is to look at a thing that's happened, whether in Trump's legal world, whether it's the conviction or whether it's this ruling, and saying, you know, all of this stuff is complicated. What matters most here is the framing of the two visions that these folks have and the conduct by which they comport themselves. I also think it's interesting, the Trump response to this is pretty much standard practice from the Trump playbook to sort of declare victory even when the truth is far more nuanced. You know, think about the Russian interference in 2016 and Mueller investigation, his campaigns, you know, his presidency, him being as president, impeached twice, a majority of senators voting to convict him, and then, you know, just declaring victory and saying that he was exonerated, when that's obviously not the truth, but certainly enough for his base and able to retain them and insulate him from a lot more damage, when you might have seen past presidents or candidates be damaged by these kinds of things.
Clearly, we're all just still absorbing this decision, which just came out a few moments ago. But beyond the criminal cases against former President Donald Trump, this opinion does create new precedents for all American presidents. And we want to go to Rick Hassan for that. He's a constitutional law professor at the University of California, Los Angeles. Good morning, Professor, to you.
Good morning.
Now, you've had some time to read this decision. What is your sense mean? What is your sense of what this ruling means for presidents past, present, and future?
Sure. I'm still working through the 119 pages, but this is a very presidential protective decision. It doesn't decide that there's absolute immunity for official acts in all cases, but it strongly suggests that there is, by creating this presumption that when the president acts in official acts. It says that talking to the vice president, maybe even talking to the states about election fraud, maybe even the speech he gave on January 6th could be considered official acts. It's a very fact-intensive question. It's certainly going to run out the clock before the election. So this is about as big a victory for Trump as he could have gotten, other than them accepting his really extreme view that he couldn't be prosecuted if he had not first been impeached for the conduct.
Now, recognizing that you're still working your way through the opinion, as are we, did the majority show any sensitivity to the concerns raised very vociferously, I have to say, by the minority, that this could open the door to some extreme abuses by a future president? Did they show any sensitivity to that argument at all?
Yes. Well, yeah, Justice Sotomayor's language about this creates basically a king in our president. The majority says that basically this is overstating the case. We're not really deciding that there's any immunity that applies to anything specifically. It's going back for this fact-intensive discussion. So the court says, you know, you need to take a step back. This has not been fully adjudicated yet. It chides the lower courts for rushing this through and says things should be moving much more slowly. But of course, everyone knows that we have an upcoming election, and that's been why things had been rushed in the first place. So the court says, you know, let's see how this works out in the long term.
You have been listening to live special coverage of the Supreme Court's ruling on immunity for presidents. We heard from our correspondents, Carrie Johnson, Ron Elving, Domenico Montanaro, as well as Professor Rick Hassan from the University of California, Los Angeles. There will be much more later today. We hope you'll stay tuned to NPR stations for continuing coverage on your local stations and on NPR.org, and certainly on All Things Considered later today. This is NPR News.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, partly sunny, breezy, a high of 73, a nice day to be outside. Clear, low 51 tonight, a little warmer with some sunshine tomorrow, high 78, back into the 80s Wednesday and Thursday, and a chance for some thunderstorms on Friday. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.